chapter 8. Get rid of this. And now the silliness really goes into high gear. Because this chapter, what they did is they introduced this behavioral finance discussion, but really the focus of it is technical analysis, which we'll take a quick look at. And there's a bonus assignment that you can do. And folks, you don't have to know what you're doing. In fact, you probably won't know what you're doing, but that's okay. I don't know what I'm doing. And all you have to do is act like you know what you're doing, and you should do fine, believe it or not. The investor's chief problem, and even his worst enemy, is likely to be himself. That's Mr. Benjamin Graham, Warren Buffett's teacher. He wrote that in The Intelligent Investor, and you're going to read The Intelligent Investor eventually. Make sure you read the 2002 edition with commentary by Jason Zweig. Investor psychology. What? Psychology, the study of psychos? I prefer to call it psychology. Have you heard that one? I use psychology on them, on your kids or whatever. In 1962, there was a brief recession and a sharp market downturn. The president's chief economic advisor was giving a presentation to many of the political and economic leaders of the time, describing what they were doing to right the economy. One of the attendees asks, "So when is the stock market going to recover?" The advisor curtly responded, "I am an economist, sir, not a psychiatrist." Oh, jeez. You don't think that's funny?
It is. Cool.
Okay, yes. In other words, he's saying, look, you know, I can't do anything about investor psychology. We're doing our best to get the economy working. Eventually, people will realize that, you know, the world's not going to end and the stock market will return. Because of the tremendous amount of money involved in the markets, much research has gone into trying to understand investor psychology. Some of the research is very revealing about who and what we are, not only as investors, but also as a species in general. There are three factors that rule the markets. You might have heard there's only two, fear and greed, right? No, there are three factors. Fear, greed, and greed. Greed usually wins out. Not always, but do you like that? That's another joke that you didn't laugh at. Fear, greed, and greed. And so here are some common investor weaknesses, which may or may not be on the exam on Thursday. Just make sure you've seen these. Reading too much into the recent past. Beware the permanent trend. Even though there are countless examples of investors getting on the bandwagon, just as the wagon was about to veer off into a ravine, we trick ourselves into believing it's different this time. It's a new era. The old ways of valuing stocks or real estate or bonds or whatever are gone. So these are the people who piled into Apple or gold in 2011 and 12. Did they buy oil in mid-2008 when it was $147 a barrel? 8 months later, it was $39 a barrel. How did that condo conversion flipper in 2006 work out? Oh, not so bad. Not so good. Still, it's going through foreclosure now. And eToys, the Globe, CMGI. These were internet stocks. You ever hear any of them? You heard about it? You heard? Do you remember Pets.com? That was the talking sock. Pets.com is gone, but the sock's still around, isn't it? Didn't they still the sock, the talking sock? You don't remember that? Okay. I don't have a television, so I don't remember. But they supposedly had a very famous talking sock. The Pets.com, you don't remember that? You guys were young now. That was 15 years ago. Oh, my God, I'm getting old. So just because the last 10 months or 2 years has been really good, does that mean the next 2 years are going to be good? They may be. They may not be. Perceiving randomness. Even though stock price movements in the short term are random, our brains trick us into seeing a pattern. Because we humans are heuristic. We look for patterns, even if we know or we were told that there was no pattern to bear. There's no pattern. It's totally random. But we look for a pattern. In a series of a million random digits, the probability that one digit will be repeated 13 times in a row is essentially 100%. So if you have a million random numbers, 0 through 9 random digits, and you scan through that and you see 13 sixes in a row, you would say to yourself, because you're human, well, that's not random, right? 13 in a row? And yet, if that did not happen, now we don't know which one, anyone from 0 to 9, but if that did not happen, what that tells you is that's a bad random number sequence. Because we believe, according to random theory, we according to statistics, we should see that happen at least once. But if we see that, if we see that as humans, we say, well, that's not random. In my humble opinion, that's what technical analysis, which we'll take a look at today, are guilty of finding, failing. We will discuss that today, and we will take a quick look at it, and I will do my best to explain how I think it's stupid, and you can decide whether or not you think it's something you want to do in the future. Being overconfident. Believing you know more than you think you know, or believing you are better than most other investors. And folks, you know, the truth is we only see the tip of the iceberg with regard to what's happening within a company, an industry, an economy. Think about the Federal Reserve Bank. They have tremendous amounts of research and resources at their disposal, and they don't do a very good job. Normally, they screw up from time to time. And we are usually only average or mediocre investors at best, especially if we try to decide to become traders. So I'm going to ask you a question. I want you to respond. How many people believe they are an excellent driver? How many people believe they're an excellent driver? Okay, raise your hands high because I want to count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. So excellent. 15. How many people believe they're good drivers? Raise your hands high. Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. How many people believe that they're average drivers? 1. How many people believe that they're a fair driver? 0. How many people believe they're a poor driver? 1. Okay. And this is actually, usually you don't see anybody. Nobody you say they're poor. What you see out of 100 people is 70 will say that they're excellent, you know, 20 will say that they're good, and maybe 5 will say that they're, and nobody will say that they're fair or poor. Wait, it doesn't make any sense. Average means you're average, right? And that means half of them will be below and half of them will be above. And so it's called the Lake Wobegon effect. It's made it into the language. Have you heard of Lake Wobegon? Where all the women are strong, the men are good looking, and all the children are above average. Have you ever talked to parents how their child's always above average? Yeah. So what the idea is, we trick ourselves into believing we're really very good when most drivers are average drivers. And some are pretty poor. And some are excellent. And so I'm one of the excellent ones, by the way. So we become overconfident. Selling your winners too soon and hanging on to your losses. We discuss this a little bit in chapter 7. As humans, we hate to admit we made a mistake. So we stubbornly hold on to our losers, hoping that we will at least get back to where we bought it so we could sell it and not have a loss. Are you with me? Because we don't want to admit we made a mistake. We were wrong. The reality is that our memories are wired to forget unpleasant experiences. That's part of our adaptation mechanism. If something bad happens, we feel bad about it, but then our memories are wired to forget about it. We can recall that, but get it out of our memory. If you sell our losers, we'll quickly forget about them. But if you hang on to them, every time you look at the screen or look at your portfolio statement, you'll be reminded how stupid you were to buy it in the first place. So if you would not buy it now at this price, it's time to sell and move on to something else. However, hanging on to the winners is what makes an investor rich. Something has done well for you, people think, I've got to sell it. I've got to do something better. No, hang on to it. Peter Lynch was once asked what his worst mistake was investing. And he said, I bought Home Depot when it started out, and it went up 100%, and I sold. And people say, that's the worst you did? He goes, yeah, it then went up 20 more times. Did you get the joke? Good. So he sold it too soon. And he should have held on, and it would have went up 20 more. Okay, anyway. Now, so those are common investor weaknesses that may be on the exam on Thursday. May be there, okay? All right, good.
Are those
well, let's see. I think, hope so. Chapter 8. Yes, common investor weaknesses and failings. There they are. Okay. Now, let's review. Remember fundamental analysis? Am I going too fast? Okay, good. I hope I'm not going, because you guys are kind of logy today. You know that, like that word? That's a good word, isn't it? Logy. It means kind of like, not too excited. Is it the weather? Might be the weather, yeah. Oh, but Danielle says she loves this weather. How many people like the rain? See, that's because you're Southern Californian. He's like, oh, wow, water from the sky. Cool. never forget, I graduated. The day I graduated, it rained for 3 weeks. I couldn't ride my bike to work. Okay. The in-depth study of the financial condition and operating results of the firm. Fundamental analysis. A method of evaluating securities by attempting to measure the intrinsic value of a particular stock. Fundamental analysts study everything from the overall economy and industry conditions to the financial condition and management of companies. Simply put, the value of a stock is influenced by the performance of the company that issued the stock. The valuation models from Chapter 6, the ratio analysis from Chapter 17, these are tools of the fundamental analysts. And that's where I put my faith in. So if we review, we look at the competitive position of the company. Never forget to research their competitors, because as Peter Lynch pointed out, you often get better ideas when you look at the company and then you see their competitors. You say, well, this is a better deal. I'll go with these people. The composition, the growth in sales and earnings, the profit margins, the dynamics of the company's earnings, the composition and liquidity of the corporate resources, what assets are available, what's the capital structure, in other words, how much debt, how much equity, what's the capitalization of the company. But there are many investors who don't follow the fundamentals. They use what is called technical analysis. Now, of course, there's some people who are in between who use a little of both, or you know, there's a spectrum, but there are some that are pure technical analysts. The study of various forces at work in the marketplace and their effects on stock prices. Those who adhere to technical analysis believe that they can predict the future price of a stock by analyzing the behavior of the stock price's history and or overall stock market. They use any one or many of dozens of so-called technical indicators. Simply put, the future price of the stock is influenced by factors other than the company's fundamental future outlook. So what's some arguments in favor of this? Well, we see that stock prices do tend to move in tandem to the market as a whole. When the market is rising, most stocks rise along with it, not all. And when the market is falling, most stocks are brought down with it. You hear the term, a rising tide lifts all boats. And Warren Buffett has a great corollary or antidote to that. He says, when the tide goes out, you can see who's been swimming naked. You don't like that word. You can, when the tide goes out, you can see who has been swimming naked. You see, the tide goes out, you must be short. Oh, boy. All right. Look, that's just supply and demand at work, folks. When stocks are in favor, prices rise, and when stocks become out of favor, prices fall. Repeat after me. There has never been a reliable methodology
for predicting the
short-term
behavior of the stock market.
There are many unreliable methods for predicting the stock market. Right? I know the market is going to fall. I just don't know when. I know the market's going to go up. I just don't know when. If you try to put them together, congratulations, you'll probably do a whole lot better job than I will. You better probably do a better job just flipping a coin. But these people, even though the statistics tell us that the market in the short term is not predictable, it is random, they believe they can do it. And so what are some of the tools of technical analysis? Well, momentum buying. Momentum strategy, the trend is your friend. The market's going up, you buy. The market's going down, you sell. I don't agree. Support levels, resistance levels. The support level is a price below which a stock or the market as a whole is supposedly, for some reason, unlikely to fall. The Dow is not going to go to below 15,858. Or the S&P 500 is not going to go below 1840. Where do they get these numbers? I don't know, but they'll tell you. And then the resistance level is where it gets stuck at. It goes up to there and then down again and up to there. And what you'll see is sometimes this is true, but then it breaks out. Whoa, B. And then psychological barriers. Dow 16,000. Dow S&P 500 1,800. $100 for a stock. We'll see these when we take a look at some of the resistance here. And then this one, which is the one we're going to use, but you don't have to use it. It's a bonus assignment called the moving average. It's an average price or index level calculated using a fixed number of previous days. 15-day, 20-day, 50-day, 200-day. But first, let's take a look at this one guy's website. Now, I'm not just trying to pick on him. He is one of dozens out there. And what they want to do is they want to sign you up for $50 a month or whatever for their tools that they have. What? Their newsletter and their software programs that they use. So I'm not just trying to pick on him. Gerardo, would you turn the lights out? So this is one from a few years back. But if you go to his website, Stock Market Mentor, you'll see, you know, he has free ones, and then of course if you want the other, where did it go? Oh, here it is. 7-6. Hello. I hate computers. Okay, here it is.
Patrick at realmoney.com. Look, you can sit around and watch all the financial television you want, but there's more to successful trading than just buying a bunch of ticker symbols because somebody on TV says they like the company. If you want to turn mad money, fast money, and on the money into your money, you got to buy these stocks right. Now that's where I come in. My job is to look beyond the company and focus on what really matters right now, the stock. So let's get off the couch and make some trades. Today we've got a Mad Money trifecta with Cisco, Shaw Group, and Amazon. Let's get started. Cisco, 3 points to make on this. First, let's use the last year of prices in order to get a measurement of the minimum upside of the stock until the next prolonged congestion. Here's how we do it. We take $11 down at the bottom to $28 up at the top. That's this last level of congestion in the early part of 2007. From there, we add that $11 onto the 28, which is the breakout, and what do we come up with? $39. So $39 is our target for this particular move. Now, the next thing we want to do is measure the quality of the trend. And the way we do that is we look and see how the prices tag these upper Bollinger Band lines all the way until here. Now, this acts as current resistance. And the next time the price gets up to that level, it really needs to push higher if this uptrend is going to remain intact. Current support is down here. It's about $1.50 below the current price level. That leads us to the last point, and that is we put a protective stop here, so we're risking about $1.50 on the downside in order to make $7.50 on the upside. That's a pretty good risk.
Do you understand what he's doing? No? He's saying because the stock went from here up to here, he believes that the next time it makes its breakout, it's going to go from here up to there, $11 jump. And he's saying that what's happened is here's the resistance level. It's having a hard time. The current resistance level is right here. It's having a hard time breaking out of the resistance level on the top side. But the support level is down here. It's not going to go below that. So what he's going to do is he's going to buy the stock, and he's going to put a protective stop right here. He's going to tell his computer system, or tell his broker, but it's all electronic now, that if the stock falls below this resistance level, sell it. That's what traders say they do. They have these protective stops to keep them from losing too much money. Because he's willing to risk $1.50 down for what he believes is $7 on the way up. Now, is there any research that shows that this is what happens? None. They are just using what they believe is how things work. But there's no research that says because the stock's going from here to here, that the next time it has an upswing, it's going to go $11 up if it went from $11 that way. It's not to be found. If you can find it, please show it to me. Because I'd love to read it. I've read some of these things, and they're just, to me, it looks like voodoo. It just looks like, you know, what is it? Rolling the dice or cutting out the entrails of a chicken and throwing them on the ground or throwing tea leaves or whatever. It's just there's no scientific basis for it. But that doesn't mean people don't use it. They do. And so you're going to hear other people say, oh, no, Piano doesn't know what the hell he's talking about. Here, read this book or go to my website and I'll show you how to do it. Are you with me? Any questions? Any thoughts? See, I tell you my bias right up front because I want you to know that that's my bias, but you're going to hear other people say no.
For me. Shaw Group. Now, first thing about this, in fact, we'll make 3 points here. First thing is we've got the stock at a new high. Now, that's important because it means that the only selling pressure now is going to be from profit-taking. There's no losers who bought at higher prices now looking to break even. Okay, that leads us to the second point, which is congestion. We can see this congestion is indeed profit-taking, and we look at the low volume here. That really confirms this. If there was any real aggressive sellers, there'd be high volume here. So this is just your normal profit-taking after a big move. Last point. How strong is the uptrend? Let's look at this in a Bollinger Band frame of reference. We can see that half of the prices here in this congestion are outside the upper band. That indicates some really strong buying, and that gives us our stop frame of reference, which is just below the breakout level. As long as the stock stays above this level, I think it's safe to hold it. And when the stock moves up above this current resistance level, that's an indication that we're on to the next high. Amazon quadrupled their profits over the last quarter.
So do you understand what he's saying? He's not saying anything about Shaw Group's earnings, their products, their competitors, their liquidity, how much cash they have on hand. He's not using any of the tools that we've learned. He's just saying, look, the price went up here. It went down. It went from, 40 down to 9. Now it's back up to 40. It's time for it to break out. It's time for it to go higher. Who says so? He says so. And it'll be $40 a month to go with them. Are you with me? Understand? Okay, so I just want to make sure, because, you know, my job is to teach you this stuff. It's not to tell you whether it's good or bad, but I think it's horrible. So that's my personal opinion. Any questions? Any thoughts? Okay, and there are more that are free. If you go to his website, there are several that are free. He has his top 10 trading rules. So you can follow them if you want. So the next one is the moving average, and that's if you want to do the stuff he does, you go right ahead because I'm going to ask you to do this. And remember, you don't have to know what you're doing; you just have to act like you know what you're doing. The moving average is one of the easiest technical indicators to understand. You go back 15 days, or 50 days, or 200 days, and you take the average of the prices over those days. And as you move through time, the next day, you do it again. And you do it again. That's what's called a moving average. Make sense? Okay, so what we do is we compare the 15-day to the 50-day, or the 50-day to the 200-day average. So what we're doing here is we're saying, look, here's the Starbucks, the blue line, and you see the price is pretty volatile. It's a stock. And we compare that to the 50-day moving average. This is the red. That goes back 50 days and moves through time. That's computers make life easier that way, because calculating that would be a pain in the neck every day. But here's the 200 day. So you see the 50 day smooths out that blue line, and the 200 day smooths it out even more. And supposedly, when the 50 day goes above the 200 day, or the 15 day goes above the 50 day, when the shorter one goes above the longer one, that's the time to buy. And when it goes below the if it were to go below the come on, Frank, talk. If we were going to below the 200 days, that's the time to sell. So I have a little presentation for my online students. You want to see that? Okay, let's take a look at that. I've already done it, so I don't want to do it again and screw up, because I might as well. Okay, show you the one I have. Here it is. Technical analysis example.
We are looking here at the brand new, hardly destroyed Yahoo Finance page.
Oh, they destroyed it.
And not because I want to show you the Yahoo Finance page, because I want to show you the technical analysis tools that Yahoo and many other...
Oh, come on, stop talking, Plano. Here's Qualcomm.
We noticed that Qualcomm is now a...
You know what? Forget it. I'm going to do it myself, because I'm getting... I do sound bored, don't I? It must have been... Okay, so here's Qualcomm. Let's take a look at Qualcomm.
You sounded younger.
I sounded younger? Uh-oh, that's not good. I want to be wise. Qualcomm. I want to be wise and wisdom. Okay, so here, have you gone to Yahoo? Used Yahoo or Bloomberg or whatever? So Yahoo, or looking at Qualcomm, Yahoo has this basic technical analysis that they give you for free. All these other websites, they want you to pay for it. So we go to basic technical analysis, and we're going to take a look at the 5 year. So this is the last 5 years, and we see that, hey, it's not done too badly. So what we're going to add to that, and these are all technical indicators, and you can study those and take a look at those to your heart's content. But we're going to just take a look at the moving average. So we go to 5 years, and we'll take a look at the 50-day and the 200-day. Some people look at the 5-day and the 20, the 10, the 50, but we're going to take a look at the 50 and the 200. So we add the 50-day moving average, and what it does is it smooths out. You see the stock price is more volatile? Going back 50 days smooths out the prices. And then we're going to add on to that the 200-day moving average. And so we see it smoothed out even more. The red is smoothed out even more because it's going back 200 days. So here was an example. The 50-day went above the 200-day moving average. And that's supposedly a very good time to buy. Well, in this case, was it a good time to buy? Do you see the stock price then zoom up? It was a great time to buy. And then here, wait a minute. It looks like the 50-day is going below but it didn't quite go below. So you were supposed to wait until now. You were supposed to wait until here until it went below, but wait a minute. It already dropped. It was too late. The price had already dropped. Are you with me? You understand what's going on? And then the next time when it goes above the 50-day goes above the 200-day, well, the price has already jumped back up. But then it still does go up, so this turns out that it really was not a bad time. But now, if we waited until now to sell the stock, it's already dropped. So we've sold it we've already sold it. We've already lost it. We didn't sell it until the 50-day told us to, going below the 200-day, but it's already dropped. And now it goes back above, and we're like, we're not going to touch that again. And now it was a good time to buy. So looking at, if you were to go back and actually put these into have you done the t-test and the student's t in statistics? Have you done those hypothesis testings? If you were to go back and do this, you would find that there's no correlation whatsoever. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. That's what the statistics tell us. But people who believe in these will tell you, "Oh no, you should have looked at the 20-day and the 50-day. You were looking at the wrong ones, or you needed to add these Bollinger bands, which I don't know what the hell they do, but they look cool when you put them at them. You add the Bollinger bands. That's why I add the Bollinger bands. And don't they look cool, Bollinger bands? I think it has something to do with the variance. I don't know. Read it and study it." But you, dear students, will be told by certain individuals, "Oh, yeah, I'm a technical analyst. I studied this. I studied that. I studied that. Come to one of our meetings and sign up for our our website, and you'll be a millionaire. Are you with me? Do you believe it? Neither do I. It's up to you. It's up to you. Up to you. Up to you. Okay, so continue. The Dow theory. One of the more historically popular price movement technical theories is called the Dow theories. It uses the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which we know to be really one of the worst indexes out there, and the Dow Jones Transport Average, which isn't too bad because it just shows transport companies, which we know is before stuff can be sold, it's got to get there. The Dow theory tries to identify three forces: a primary direction or trend, a secondary reaction or trend, and daily fluctuations. By watching the changes in the primary and secondary directions of the indexes, you are supposed to be able to determine the overall direction of the market. And yet, nobody's been able to explain it to me. I've had two different people try to explain it to me. And what it looks like to me is that sometimes the market goes up and sometimes it goes down. I think that's what they're saying. I'm not sure. See, here's the primary direction. It's down. But there are secondary directions where it goes up and then down and then up and then down. And then it goes back up again and then down again. Can you figure out anything? If you can figure it out, explain it to me, because I'd love to know. Relative strength. This is used by one company called the Investors Business Daily. They're a competitor to the Wall Street Journal. They're out of L.A. And the Value Line also likes the relative strength. This is a measure of the performance of one investment relative to another and to the market as a whole. Coca-Cola has a relative strength much higher than its competitor, Pepsi-Cola. And they'll give you the number. Market volume. Heavy volume versus low volume. They look at whether there's heavy volume with prices rising. That's supposed to be a good sign. Low volume with prices falling. That's okay. Prices are falling, but it's low volume. Don't worry about it. But if there's heavy volume with prices falling, oh, that's bad. Run for the hills. And if there's low volume with prices rising, that's not supposed to be good either. Hey, prices are rising, but there's not enough volume, so it's time to sell. That you decide whether or not you believe that. The breadth of the market, not the respiration, but how many companies went up, how many companies went down, how many stocks went up, how many went down. When the mood of investors is bullish, the advance decline ratio should rise. Advancing issues should outnumber declining issues. When the mood of investors is bearish, the advance decline ratio should fall. Declining issues will outnumber advancing issues. Again, there's no research to back this up. You go back in time, it doesn't mean it's true, but people will believe it. And then the tick. The tick. Remember the tick we did when we were doing our did it go up, did it go down, is it sideways? Looking at the trade-by-trade direction of the market. Is it an uptick? Is it a downtick? What's the opening tick? How many stocks went up? How many stocks went down? When the closing tick? And then what, if it's bullish tick, more of the market's going up. If it's a bearish tick, and ticks are blood-sucking incense. So figure that one out. Now, short interest. Are you excited about this? No?
Yes.
Me neither. Okay, that's good. Thank you. Short interest. Now, this one actually is pretty good. This one, but again, you're just looking at it as overall. It's not something I would make an investment decision using. But the number of stocks sold short in the market at any given time. The more stocks are sold short, and we'll discuss selling short in detail at the end of the semester, the more investors believe the market will fall. Because when you sell short, you are believing that prices will fall. If you believe a company is going to go under, you would sell the stock short and it could go to zero. But that's it. It can't go below zero. And you would have won. For some reason, short investors are somehow considered more sophisticated and are therefore supposed to know when the market will fall. But when large number of investors sell short, eventually they must buy back the shares, which creates a pent-up demand. So what you'll see with a stock or the market as a whole, you'll see this up and down, and all of a sudden it'll do a dive, and people will freak out. And they go, Frank, what are you doing? What are you doing? I said, no, just wait a couple of days. Because then, bingo, it jumps back up again. Because these people sold short, and then they had to buy it back. And when they buy it back, it's like a spring pushing down. Selling short, it's like a spring. You push down and then, bingo, it has to jump back up again. I remember 2002, August 2002, where it was we read that the largest number of shares have been sold short in the history of the New York Stock Exchange. And I said, okay, we're getting near the end. 2000 to 2002 was like water torture. 2008 was like a bolt of lightning out of the sky. 2000 to 2002 is like somebody just dropping water on your nose every day. So let's take a look at a stock. Let's take a look at Qualcomm and go to the key statistics, and we'll see that every stock has an amount of short interest. And the market as a whole has that. So there are 1.69 billion shares, but only 21.5 million shares that are sold short. That's 1.3%. The short interest is 1.3%. So what does that mean? Do investors think Qualcomm's going to go down? No, they're actually pretty darn optimistic about Qualcomm's future. Because if this were high, if this were like 10, 20, 30%, that means that investors are thinking, uh-oh, Qualcomm's. How about JCPenney's? Let's take a look at JCPenney's. Yeah, actually, they're doing better, folks. Believe it or not, let's see. Their short interest was huge for a while. It's still probably pretty high. Look at that. See, this is the time to buy pennies. If they don't, they're a turnaround. If they don't go under, this stock price is going to zoom. There are 304, and that's not a recommendation. There are 304.6 million shares outstanding. But get the cursor out of the way. But look how many shares have been sold short. 290 shares float. 130 million shares have been sold short. Yeah. So they're saying that the short interest is 85%. That doesn't make sense. But are investors thinking that JCPenney's is going to go under? Yeah. And could it? I don't think they're going to go under. I think what might happen, and I thought this, you know, from looking at their financials, because they got a lot of resources, folks. They own an insurance company that's very profitable. They're the ones that sell insurance to when babies are born. They go out, the Gerber baby. What might happen is they just might downsize. They might just become a lot smaller than they are now, and the mall operators are freaking out because that they're one of the. They call them the anchors in the malls. Yes. Yeah. No, they're borrowing shares in the optimism that it's going to go down. What they've done is they've borrowed the shares and they've sold them. They sold something they don't own. So now they are required. I know, doesn't it sound illegal?
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't sound legal, but it's not very legal. You've made a contract saying that you will buy it back. You understand? Because if you disappear, the brokerage firm has to buy them back. Or if the shares start going up and you don't contact the brokerage firm, they'll buy them back for you. They're allowed to do that. You made a contract that said if you disappear or if you start losing too much money, we're going to buy them back for you because you have to buy them back. There's an old saying: he who sells what isn't his'n must buy it back or go to prison. Well, that's not true. He who sells what isn't his'n must buy it back and go to prison. So what we're seeing here is that there are a lot of people, a lot of investors who believe that JCPenney's is going to go under. Now, what happens if JCPenney starts to come back, which it looks like they are, it doesn't mean they are, then those people are going to freak out. They're going to have to buy back the shares, and the price will boom. Yes, Canola?
There's transaction tax.
There's always a commission. Did you a transaction tax?
When they're buying the shares, they're selling the shares. If they still pay 100 shares, they still pay a tax on them? No?
They have to pay a commission, and they have to pay interest. Well, tax if you make money. If you make money, yes. And they're not capital gains. They're taxed as income. It's by definition short term. It's not long term capital gains. Yeah, selling short, you're taxed as income. We'll discuss.
When they buy buy it and it goes up and they lose money, do they still have to buy to pay back the shares they borrow?
If you see, that's why selling short is really dangerous, folks. Don't do it. Don't do it. Peter Lynch says don't do it. If you bet wrong, because you're betting, you're gambling, and the price is going to go down. And if you bet wrong and the price goes up, you start to lose a lot of money quickly. And then if you don't buy them back, the brokerage firm will buy them back for you. And you wrote, you clicked on there, you signed that was okay. They watch you like a hawk. And supposedly these people are supposed to be sophisticated investors. Well, I only know a couple people have done it, and one of them wasn't sophisticated at all. I begged him not to do it because he was so sure that the housing market was going to crash. So he started selling short the housing builders, the mortgage lenders, and he was absolutely right. This was 2005 and 6, but he was two years too early, and he lost. You know, he lost a lot of, I mean, for him it was a lot of money. For anybody it would be a lot of money. Are you with me? Yeah, don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it. We'll get to selling short more in more detail. Odd lot trading. How are we doing for time? Not bad. This is the theory based on the idea that small investors tend to buy and sell in odd lots. An odd lot, what is an odd lot, folks? Less than 100. What's a round lot? Yeah, you got to know that. Recall that an odd lot is less than 100 shares. And the theory is that the best thing to do is the opposite of what the small investors are doing. If odd lot trading rises, it supposedly means that more and more small investors are entering the market. And supposedly, for some odd reason, small investors are supposedly notorious for getting into the market at the top of a bull market. Well, this is true sometimes, but not all the time. The research and the data behind this theory are very suspect. Plus, technology has made odd lot trading commonplace. So I don't put any credence into this, but you decide. Contrarian opinion. Now, this is actually one of those things that makes a lot of sense, but it's just hard to quantify. The theory is if people are very optimistic, that is a predictor of falling prices for the market. And if people are very pessimistic, that's a predictor of rising prices, right? Buy when others are actively selling, sell when others are actively buying. Now, the problem is then, if we would just all walk around, oh man, the market's going to fall, oh man, that'll make the market go up, right?
Yes.
I don't think so. So we should all be really, the world is going to end, that'll make the market go up. We covered contrarian strategy ahead in investment strategies. Buy when others are selling, sell when others are buying. The problem is the market historically has gone up three times more than it goes down. There's a guy named Mark Hulbert. Mark Hulbert, he's very famous. What he did back in the early 80s is he subscribed to all these different newsletters, all these investment newsletters. And he didn't subscribe because he wanted to know the information and act on it. What he started doing was just quantifying how bullish they were, how bearish, and how neutral they were. And it turns out when they're all bullish, that's been the time to sell. And when they're all, or mostly bearish, that's been the time to buy. So he publishes this now, and people act on his publish. So you think, you understand? If all the newsletters were bearish, if they just were bearish because they wanted to screw up Mr. Hulbert's his research, then everybody would believe the stock market's going to go up, and so they'd buy, and the stock market would go up. Because everybody would be buying. But exactly, I know. You can, it's like this, you're chasing your tail. I'm trying to catch your tail. Charting is, we saw some charts, the resistance and the support levels and the breakout and the head and shoulders and the triangles and the flags and pennants. This is looking at the squiggles on a screen. And there are people who tell you this is how to do it. They'll sell you these software programs. They'll buy our newsletter. The activity of charting price behavior and other market information and then using the patterns these charts form to make investment decisions. There's high, low, close charts, candlestick charts. Let's take a look at these candlestick charts. They are showing you the high and the low, and if it read, it ended lower than when it started. So it started here, ended there, and that was the variance. And supposedly, by looking at these, You can determine. Here's some congestion. Oh, it's going to break out on the upside. No, it's going to break down on the downside. Yeah, the candlestick chart. If it ends higher than it started, it's gray. If it ends lower, it's black. And so they have these candlestick chart formations. Here, day one, it went well, but then, it went down. So that's a dark cloud cover. With me, dark cloud. And here is a bearish engulfing pattern. That's even worse. And then this one's supposed to be the worst. I don't know what it stands for. Harami? I think it's Japanese. Maybe it has to do with a hit. How do you say it? Harikari? Harikiri? Killing yourself? So you gonna trade on these? What's Harikari? We say Harikari, but it's actually, how do you say it? Harikiri. Anybody know how to say it?
Hello Kitty.
No, not Hello Kitty. Harikari. You've heard Harikari, right?
No.
You never heard of Harikari? How do you say it? Hirakiri. That's how you say it. That's the Japanese formal way of killing yourself. You've dishonored the family. And then here is the most infamous one of them all. The head and shoulders pattern. This is really bad. And what this means is that there's the neckline, there's the left shoulder, there's the head, there's the right shoulder, and that's bad. That's the only question I got on the Series 7. Yeah, right. The head and shoulders. They just wanted you to identify one of the most famous technical patterns around called the head and shoulders. And then here are some others. There's the resistance level. It's not going to go above that. There's the support level. It's not going to go below that until it does. And that's called a breakout. That's breaking out on the upside. And here's breaking out on the downside. And then here are triangles. I don't know why they're called triangles, but they're called triangles. Here's a flag, and that's supposed to be okay, but a pennant's supposed to be better. Again, the research behind these, wrong. There's something wrong with it. See, your bonus assignment is to do this, is to be a technical analyst. And this is real technical analyst, folks. This person was sitting on Wall Street making a lot of money, and you can do it too. The market's rise after a period of reaccumulation is a bullish sign. Nevertheless, fulcrum characteristics are not yet clearly present, and the resistance area exists 40 points higher in the Dow. So it is clearly premature to say the next leg of the bull market is up. If, in the coming weeks, a test of the lows holds and the market breaks out of its flag, a further rise would be indicated. Should the lows be violated, a continuation of the intermediate-term downward trend is called for. In view of the current situation, it is a distinct possibility that traders will sit in the wings awaiting a clearer delineation of the trend, and the market will move in a narrow trading range. Now, what do you think he said? What do you think he said? I think he said, if the market does not go up or down, it will remain unchanged. Is that what you think he said? I think that's what he said. This is from A Random Walk Down Wall Street. You really need to read this book eventually. It's a lot of fun. He skewers everybody. He goes after the technical analyst, he goes after the fundamental analyst, and he goes after the efficient market theorist. And so what I did for the online students, and I'll do it for you, is I created a spreadsheet that, because I know I studied statistics in my undergrad, and I really had a great time with it. So this is a random chart. It's basically going back a year and mimicking what stocks do using random number generators. And what you find is if you hit function key 9, it recalculates. And you do that, and what you will see eventually are some of these patterns. Like here. Here it up, and then there's the resistance level, and then it broke out, and then it hit another support level. So here's the support level, and there's the resistance level. But it's a flag, so it's going to go up. But if you press the function key 9 again, it uses something different. And then if you just continue to press it, it looks like something, if anybody's ever worked with an oscilloscope, it's called white noise. It's just random patterns that are created. But because we're humans, We search for some kind of pattern that we try to imbue, we try to give meaning to. And even if we know, and then I know because I did it, I put all the statistics in here and it's all randomly generated, and yet you can see that, oh yeah, there's a pattern involved. And yet the statistics tell us that there isn't. Questions, thoughts, ideas? That's the seeing, hear things that are not there. All right, so you guys are calling. Last slide, box. The last slide, I should actually put this in the beginning. Who wants to be a stockbroker someday, huh? Just one? Just a few? Nobody? Just a few? You want to do it. She's going to get her Series 7. All right. It's not as hard as people think it is to do. You don't have to have a degree. They eventually want you to get a degree. They love Spanish speakers. Anybody who has a second language. They want more women. They want people from the military. They love ex-military because it's a structured environment. So there is a future for you, folks. You can do it. It's tough to break into to make money. It's not hard to get a job, but if they like you, what they'll do is they'll take you on as a broker's assistant, a broker's aide, and then help you get to Series 7. And then you'll be on normally a draw against commission. They'll pay you a salary so you have some money to live off of. But you'll be making very little money at first off your commissions. And after a few months, maybe 5, 6, 7 months, if you're not starting to raise your commissions high, they'll shake your hand and say, thank you very much, it's not working out. So you have to be able to produce. And how many people did you call in a day, Yosana? 500. So I know Yosana's going to do well because you weren't a stockbroker at the time. She was calling 500 people a day trying to get them to sign up for something or other. And that's basically what you have to do. You have to really enjoy having people tell you no. But if you survive those first few months, it's a very fun. I love it. I'm lucky because I live off of this salary and everything I do there. I don't have to make call. I don't have to call 500 people a day. You didn't call 1,000 people a day. No. I mean, you were calling. Keep calling. But you did make some sales, right? That's what it's like, folks. If you think you could do that, you could get into this business and make a lot of money. Brokers make a lot of money. They can. They don't have to. If you don't make a lot of money, it means you're not doing it right and you're not enjoying it. So, well, figure 80 grand after the first couple of years, up to 200,000 after several years. Is that good enough for you?
No?
After a few years, brokers are usually making about 80,000. Well, that's a good question. When you're doing the cold calling, it's usually in the morning and in the evening hours. In the afternoon, you usually are asked to go to a client, there's a lot of steak dinners and taking them to the golf course. This is the stuff that I am so far removed from. I don't wear a suit, folks. When I visit, every once in a while, when I visit a client that may be really hoity-toity, I'll wear a suit. But I don't wear a suit when I visit my clients. My clients are putting $50 a month away. $100 a month away. When you're going to a client and you're trying to land $1 million or $12 million account, you wear a suit, you drive you don't go to JCPenney's. You don't use JCPenney's clothing. You drive up. My old Tercel, my boss she's retired now, but she was so upset. You don't go to clients, and I park about a half a mile away, a quarter mile away, and walk. You know, so then they didn't see my car. I said, "Can I just show them my portfolio?" Said, no, you can't do that. You got to show up. You have to. She wanted me to get. It's a long story, but they're going to do a background check. They're going to make sure you have no shenanigans with other people's money. You have to pass the Series 7. It is a tough test, but it is not impossible. It takes about 2 months of studying, 1 to 2 hours a day. You're going to take these exams over and over and over again, these practice exams, until you can recite this stuff in your sleep. And then after you take the exam, you will probably forget it all. Not all of it. The stuff that I teach this class as if you were going to take the Series 7, but the stuff they ask you, which is, I mean, how many days do you have from rolling over an IRA to put it into the IRA? I mean, you would look that up if you needed it. You wouldn't try to remember that. I'm not a walking encyclopedia. That's what they have computers for. The brokerage firm will sponsor you. It used to be that some brokerage firms existed simply to sponsor people, but not anymore. The brokerage firms are losing brokers because these are brokers who started in the 60s and 70s, and they're retiring, and they need new people. So as I said, they need women. They need, if you have a second language, if you're ex-military, they're looking for you. They want diversity. And they need it. Any questions, any thoughts? With this class, you go to one of these job fairs, bring them the syllabus, get your best duds on, not the JCPenney stuff, and get your resume, not a single error in your resume, and sell yourself. And we've had students from this class become broker's assistants, broker's aides. Okay, you ready for the exam? No? Chapter 17, make sure you can divide two numbers. 7, can you beat the market? 8, investor psychology, learn some of these. As long as you can identify them, support level, resistance level, moving averages. Chapter 5, review. 6, constant perpetual, growth model, discounted cash flow models, calculator, one-page notes, formula sheets. Be awesome. Bring honor and glory to Southwestern College. Yes? Well, just review the stuff that we went over. Just review. Yeah, a lot of it. A lot of the questions, like, what's an odd lot? What's a spread? You know, those kinds of things. Everything about stocks. You got to know that stuff. So review it. Don't try to learn it. If you haven't done any studying, don't try to learn it in 2 days. Okay.